What is going on, guys? Welcome to Fightful for our interview with John Finkel. He is the author of the new book, Macho Man, The Untamed, Unbelievable Life of Randy Savage. It is coming out on April 2nd, right before WrestleMania. John, how are you?
I am awesome, and thank you so much for having me on.
Man, it is my pleasure. When I saw that I had an opportunity to talk about Macho Man Randy Savage, I took it. I will always take it because I came down to Mega Powers. All my friends had Hogan, not this guy. This guy had Macho Man because Macho Man was just cool. He had that voice and he was just different. And I was always the guy that liked different things. And Macho Man was just as cool as he could be. So when I had the shot at talking about Macho Man, I'm taking it. So thank you for, more importantly, thank you for writing the book. So it gave me something to talk about. But what read that it took you, I saw on your website, you said it was something that was 20 years in the making for you, but it took you 18 months to basically write it and then get the books. When was that moment for you that you're like, I'm going to write a Macho Man autobiography, and how's the process of getting started? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, I wanted to write the definitive Macho Man biography as long as I've been an author. And so this is actually my 10th book. I've done some larger biographies on other athletes and other teams and other topics. And I'd always had this one in the back of my head. And so when you mentioned earlier, 20 years in the making, it's like, as my early 20s, thinking about being a writer, I wrote for Muscle and Fitness and Men's Fitness and GQ and a lot of dude type magazines. When I was at Muscle and Fitness, I was lucky enough to do a lot of cover stories with WWE guys. I did a big cover story with Batista and Triple H, and Brock Lesnar, and a lot of guys like that. And so I spent time with them. I even did some workouts with them for as part of the stories. And I just was like, man, nobody has ever tackled the Macho Man biography. I always assumed there must have been some reason why. So I went off and wrote, biographies of other athletes and other things. And I also knew to do a book like this right, I kind of had to have a few books under my belt, some confidence, because Macho, of all the athletes and books that I've written, he meant the most to me. Like growing up, just like you, the Mega Powers, I was the perfect age for all of this. I believed everything. So I think that's like an important factor for people listening to understand who may be a little younger or maybe just kind of getting into wrestling for whatever age. But at the time of Macho Man's peak, coming in WrestleMania 3, winning the Intercontinental Championship before that, Tito Santana and Ricky Steamboat, all these things that happened, I was 9, 10, 11, believing everything. I believed he broke Steamboat's larynx. I loved him, but like didn't understand why he would do that. I believed the moment when Hulk rescued him, believed that all of a sudden my two of my three favorite wrestlers were coming together. And that whole storyline, everything, I was so all in, like it affected me. I remember sitting in the cafeteria with my friends talking about, wait a minute, did Hulk have his hand on Elizabeth's butt? And is Macho being a little like crazy here? And then when they finally shook hands to get together, that was like the moment of like my entertainment life at that point. So he just meant so much. And I didn't want to do the book in a way where I couldn't, do it right and take the time I needed to and interview all the people I wanted to and cover all the angles and really go from, as I got older and am an adult myself, the transformation from a guy named Randy Poffo, who wanted to be a baseball player and came pretty close, played in the minors. I wanted to spend a lot of time there, to the Randy Savage, renegade outlaw ICW guy in the 70s, to the icon that we grew up loving, Macho Man. That was the story I always wanted to tell. And when I was finally able to feel comfortable and confident that I could do it, that was probably, like I said, a 20-year kind of run. And then it took about a year and a half from contract to finishing the book.
Very, very cool. And, that when you brought it up about like Elizabeth, I was just thinking, like, right when you said her name, I'm like, that was probably my first crush.
He's up there, Elizabeth and like, yeah. Kelly Kapowski.
Yeah. But I was just like thinking, I'm like, that might've been my first crush. Now that I think about it, but that had to be interesting, just reaching out to people, talking to people. I know you talked to his brother, Lanny. What was that like, just getting stories? Because he's been nothing before he unfortunately passed away. He told a lot of great stories about Randy. And what was your interactions with him like?
Yeah, the book would have probably come out about a year and a half earlier if I was able to get in touch with him. So it took a very long time to get in touch with Lanny, is what I'm saying. Like, it just, if I had gotten in touch with him the day I was ready to do the book, the proposal was done and publishers were interested, we'd have been having this conversation a year and a half ago or so. So he was incredible. He was very like reclusive towards the end of his life. Not like he spent half the year in Ecuador. He kind of only talked to a few people unless he was out doing media and doing signings and things. And so I got very lucky that I had a contact from my book before this, 1996, who I did a whole chapter on the Rock and Stone Cold debuting in 1996 in the WWE, WWF then, and then E. And so I reached out to him. I knew he had done this guy, JP Zarka, who does Pro Wrestling Stories, which is a cool blog. And he did a couple podcasts with Lanny. And I said, hey, can you, put us in touch? And he vouched for me. And then from that point on, it was like a year before we finally spoke. And to me, I wasn't going to do the book unless I talked to Lanny. It didn't feel right, number one, having him be the last living, PAFO and kind of the de facto torchbearer of the family. And two, for moments like this, I couldn't imagine if he was still alive, if you said, did you talk to Lanny? And I was like, no, I would be listening and be like, well, how did you not talk to his brother? Mm-hmm. Like, he's the guy. So when I was willing to delay everything to talk to him, I finally talked to him. Of course, his first joke was with my last name, Finkel. It was like, he related to Howard Finkel. And I said, no, but my dad's Harvey Finkel. So the same initials, maybe that counts for something. And he laughed. He liked little things like that. And then he grilled me on some macho questions that, I guess I passed. They weren't like, do you know this? This was more just like, what do you think of that? And how do you feel about this part? And those kind of things. And after the first 10 or 15 minutes, he was like, I like you. I think you sold me. I think you can do this. I think you have the chops, or some word he used. He liked words, as we know, the genius. And then we spoke for like 2.5-3 hours. And he answered, I had 30 questions, and I was like, I'm going to go until you tell me to stop. And I kept going. And then as I was writing the book, I kept notes where he said he'd be available every now and then for if I had to clarify things. And we covered everything I would have liked to. Of course, I was still researching, so new things come up, small things that I wanted to clarify or just say, hey, like, when you were in Toledo, like, where'd you live, or what was this like, or those kind of things. And then sadly, I got the call that he passed away, and I had the notebook next to me. Lanny Q's right there. It was very sad. I dedicated the book to him, and I just hope I did his memory proud and family memory proud.
Reading the book, I definitely think you did, because it was very good. And that's the one thing about the publisher, ECW Press, who you went through the book. They've done a lot of wrestling books. Yeah. So when I saw that to publish a book, I knew we were getting a good book, because
yeah, I look, it matters. It's like, you want to find a team behind you who knows how to push these books and help you promote these books, but also has a history with getting these books out and respecting what people, really feel about the industry itself. It's not a niche, because it's too big to be a niche, but it's definitely like a genre all to itself. And so you have very hardcore fans who know everything about, Jerry Lawler in 1976, and people who follow everything tightly from the territory days all the way to, total casuals who just remember screaming "Ooh yeah!" and watching a WrestleMania at their friend's house. And, so you really have to know the spectrum of people who are going to be reading it and keep that in mind.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. What was, while you were doing your research on Randy, what is something that surprised you the most learning about him?
I didn't realize how much baseball meant to him throughout, basically like, 7-8 years old to the time he quit. There really was no thought of wrestling. It wasn't like he hedged his bets and thought he'd be either a wrestler or a baseball player. It wasn't like he had just always figured, if baseball doesn't work out, like, I could wrestle. He was a baseball player. The man was born to be a baseball player. In fact, he did everything in his power to play baseball. He had a batting cage. His dad built a batting cage on the side of the house. He famously went through his high school carrying his book bag and his bat bag. He sit in the back of classes with weighted balls to strengthen, weighted baseballs to strengthen his wrists and forearms. And he would do these, a bunch of people remember him doing tricep kickbacks for his throwing arm with like a half-pound ball like in his hand. Like, he was that kid. They remember he didn't go out very much. He studied baseball. He would spend an hour in the cage before a game, an hour in the cage after the game. He was completely and totally dedicated to becoming a baseball player. He had studied hitting books. He batted 500 as a righty as a junior in high school, and then learned to switch hit on his own, and then batted 500 from as a lefty. He was it. He didn't get drafted, which was incredible. No one in his life thought that was possible, but then he made a tryout with the Cardinals. He gets signed out of, there's 350 people show up for a tryout. He's the only one who gets signed. And from that point till the minute he finally washed out after his fourth or fifth attempt and he got an injury in his right arm, so he taught himself to throw lefty so he could keep going. And from that minute till he quit, there was no thought of like, oh, I'll just wrestle. I never realized that he was, and it, to me, it speaks to like the ability to transform. You know, it's a real story of reinvention, really. He's reinvented himself many times over in the book. But I didn't know that. I'd heard he played minor league baseball, but it's kind of like, oh, so he probably played baseball and wrestled on the side, and, you know, one didn't work out, so he went to the other. But he was beyond crushed, completely devastated, and never once thought he would be anything but a major league baseball player until baseball finally, you know, that door finally closed.
Yeah, that's, I knew he had a huge, like, he loved baseball, and like he was with the Cincinnati Reds organization. Like, this is his baseball card, that not the best graphic there, but I mean, that's just kind of cool that exists out there. What positions did he play?
Or so he was a catcher. He was the best catcher in Downers Grove in the county. He was the best player on his high school team. In fact, his high school team actually ended up producing a few pros, surprisingly, but he was the guy people went to see. The stands were packed with scouts while he was there. He could do everything. I mean, almost everybody that you talk to, I talked to his high school coach, I talked to all his teammates. Even in the offseason, he would, you know, play on these like minor league or semi-pro teams, and he would just mash. I mean, there was times where he would basically go, you know, you look at the box scores of his, and you can find them all in, you know, the old Downers Grove newspapers, the old papers around Chicago area, and it's just like 4-for-5, 4-for-5, 3-for-5, 2-for-4. Like, he just didn't go games without hitting. He famously got pissed off a bunch of times when he would walk a man on second or third, and he would demand that he would be arguing that it wasn't a ball to stay in the plate so he could hit again. You know, he was nuts, and he was dedicated all that energy that became, you know, we can see the kind of the deep core of him for Macho. But baseball wise, I mean, that was what he wanted to do. And the when the dream died, it physically broke him. He went to one of his high school teammates who happened to be in the minors that night, slept on his couch with a very much that existential crisis, like, now what do I do with my life? He drove home at whatever time in the morning. He's seeing him out there shattering his bats against his childhood tree that he used to hit against. He used to have a tire that would hang from the tree, and he would hit it to strengthen his forearms. I mean, this all he ate, you know, slept and breathed baseball for 20 something years, and then it ended. And he woke up the next day being who he was and said, let's wrestle.
Yeah, that's something else. And he went to the Southern Illinois University, and I did a lot of research like myself on him, and he lived a fascinating life, just like with the baseball. Like, his last season, he played Class A ball, 16 home runs, over 100 RBIs, just very interesting. Just even to know, like, if I would have been a child knowing that he was a baseball player before that, that would have been just something else. To just, like, wrestling and baseball were two of my favorite of all time. Yeah. And knowing that he was a diehard baseball fan too, it's funny because when you say how much you love baseball, I remember hearing a story when WWF would do sometimes these charity softball games, and I wish I could remember the wrestler that said this, but they said Randy was the only one that when he hit the ball and it wasn't a home run, he was the only one that, like, ran. If he wanted it, he just ran like crazy.
Some video of some of those old, you know, 88, 92, and he would just mash these softballs. Like, I mean, and these are big guys, so it's not hard to get, you know, pull it out for some of these dudes. And they're all pretty athletic. None of them were, I think Randy's probably the most athletic guy that we've had in the WWE, maybe ever. I mean, there's some guys now with gymnast backgrounds and, you know, played football, and a lot of the guys played football back in the 80s and 90s, but that's something that I thought is really, really important. As you were talking about knowing he played baseball, one of the biggest things that dawned on me as I kind of did the research and started getting into the real writing of the book is, like, he's so different than all of his contemporaries and all the other wrestlers. So famously was like 6'5" in high school, right? Like, he wasn't an athlete. He was a band guy, but he was a monster guy. He was used to being the big man on campus. Any room he went into, people thought, who the hell is that giant, right? Same thing with Andre the Giant, or even, you know, Ted DiBiase played football, and Hacksaw, Jim Duggan. These were all guys who grew up. They were the guy who, if you saw in the high school hallway, you know, it's like, oh, he's 6'1", 220 as a senior in high school. He's obviously in the rest, you know, he's obviously like the heavyweight wrestler. He's an offensive tackle or a lineman or a linebacker. These were big dudes, and they carried themselves that way throughout their lives. They were used to it. Randy created a big dude. He was a skinny baseball player. He was 6 foot, listed as 6'1", like 185 for most of his minor leagues, any of the programs that you find. That's tiny. You had early on when your avatar was, you know, Dusty Rhodes. Like, Dusty has a great comment when he first saw Randy at like the Tampa Armory back in the mid-70s when he just started getting into wrestling after baseball was over. And he's like, you know, he had some talent, but he was tiny. He looked like a little kid. He was going against guys that he was giving up 40, 50, 60 pounds and a few inches on. So to me, one of the most incredible things about Randy overall is that he wasn't this big guy who decided to wrestle. He was actually a small guy who had to get big, who then decided to wrestle. And that's like so unique. So he had the athleticism of a much smaller guy, you know, put on this massive amount of muscle. So when he was in the ring with whoever it was, he was actually like, he created not only the character, he created a new physical person where no one else, Hogan couldn't go out and put on 8 inches of height. Like, he just was that tall, right? And Hacksaw's got the, you know, he's got the 2x4 and DiBiase's out there. And these are all big, beefy guys who were always big, beefy guys. Macho made, entirely created through working out and eating and some other things, a big, beefy guy, a muscular guy to compete with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah, it's his muscle training, his strength just is unbelievable. And Hogan's talked about it like in interviews, how he would leave a gym and Savage was there before him. Savage was there after him. Just stuff like that is just how much work he would put into his career. One thing that I wanted to ask you was, did you get the chance to ever see him wrestle in person?
So I've tried to figure this out, and I say this because I was pretty young when we used to go to some of these things. So I grew up in around Boston, and I was a, like I said, I watched everything. I was into everything. I had to wrestle the dolls and the action figures. I had the lunchboxes. I watched the cartoons, and Macho was my guy. Actually, early on, Big John Studd used to be my guy. I used to call myself Little John Studd, and I even met him at a grand opening for Toys R Us. My dad arranged it, and we had lunch together with our family, and it was like one of the coolest experiences of my life. And it kind of pushed me from like very into wrestling to this is the greatest thing on earth. I actually met like the guy who's Big John Studd in person. And so we used to go to like house shows at the Worcester Centrum. We went to a few, and then my uncle took us to a show at the Garden. You know, I know I saw Hulk Hogan. I remember Hulk Hogan versus Sergeant Slaughter. I remember actually seeing Big John Studd wrestle when he was in town, you know, maybe a week or two after that. And I've tried to find the cards and the dates, and it's really hard. This is, you know, you're talking. So I feel like in one of those shows, my answer is like, it's likely, but I also feel like I definitely 100% would have remembered if I for sure saw him. So I hate to say no, but I was also 8 and 9, and I just don't know if I ever actually did. It'd be a shame. It'd be awesome to know. We don't, you know, we didn't have cell phones to take pictures of everything. And so
yeah,
I got shows close. And I remember texting my uncle. I was like, is this the one? He's like, I have no idea. I got the tickets that day. I scalped them. They're not digital. I don't remember anything. I just remember the only thing we all remember is the night that we went and saw Hogan fight Sergeant Slaughter. It was one of those, like, I don't know, they must have had to catch a flight. He was out for like 90 seconds. It was like, you know, Sergeant Slaughter's out being the villain, waving the, you know, he's not in the, you know, he was anti-US at that point. I can't remember what flag he was waving, but I remember he was waving something. And then, you know, all of a sudden you hear, I am, you know, it's Hogan. Music comes on. He comes out and just like flattens him with a boot, pins him and goes. And we were like, I guess, okay, it's over, you know. But I think house shows back then were like that.
I can do a lot of, I have a lot of ways to do some research. So I'll look into it for you. I'm sure I can figure some stuff out, especially like with the John Studd Toys R Us stuff. I can do a lot of things there. So I'll find out for you.
That'd be great.
Who were some other wrestlers? Well, before I do that, there was something that I know terrified me when I was younger. It was Jake the Snake and the Snake Bite.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I stories like that Jake told about it, and that Macho wanted Jake to take the bite.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear that?
So this is one of those where like, I'm so glad I talked to Lanny, right? So they, you know, everything's an angle. They had discussed it. This is the amazing. Okay. So the day before this, they're going to possibly, you know, tape this and do it live, which was also like, do we do this at a house? How do we do this? So Lanny's in the car. They're driving. Macho's driving. Elizabeth's in the front seat and Lanny's in the back. He says in a great way, like, I'm an older brother, but he's like, I was the classic little brother. I was pretending to sleep while my older brother and his wife were having an argument. I did not. He's like, I was just lying there, kind of one eye open. I didn't intervene. And Elizabeth was like, you're not getting bitten by a snake, you moron. And he was like, oh, you know, it's, think about it on live TV. You know, he's doing the whole thing, like convincing her why it'd be great. And she's like, you could die. Like, do you trust Jake? And Macho trusted nobody, right? He didn't believe anybody was out like on his side. So he was like, no. And then she's going all about like, what are the steps if it is poisonous? Like, let's say you're in the, you know, she's doing the wife thing. Like, let's say you're in the ring. Let's say he bites you. Let's say it's poisonous. Let's say you're having a reaction. Now what? You're in the middle of the ring. Is there an ambulance there? Is there a snake expert? Is there anti-venom? And he obviously had, there was no thought behind the storyline, I guess, other than it would be really cool if he got bit on live TV, right? So yeah. They came up with this plan of if the snake bites Jake first and he's fine, then do it, because why would you do this to yourself? He's not going to die. So that's the story from the Macho Man, Landy Poffo side, is that they show up, Macho confronts him, and and Jake has said it in many, many interviews, and he's, you know, all these guys are like 70% reliable, right? They kind of, you can kind of believe them until you can't. So this one seems to have been pretty close to accurate, because it's exactly what Landy said. They talked about the day before in the car, and there was only three people in the car, and he was one of them. And unfortunately, they're all gone now. But when we spoke, he said this happened. And he went and told Jake, like, if you get bitten in the leg and you sit here for an hour and you're fine and that's the snake that's going to bite me, go for it. And that was the backstage behind the scenes version. I guess they did it. And I guess, you know, Jake has said a few times that he was pissed off. Like, it hurt. He didn't want to do it. It wasn't part of the deal. And then, you know, he couldn't get, you know, you see it on TV. He'd never practiced getting the fangs out if it didn't come out, right? So you can watch it now anytime on YouTube. Like, it was stuck in there and just kept gnawing and gnawing and gnawing. And so, you know, there's stories. I asked Landy, I guess there's a couple stories that Macho had a fever afterward. And then Macho used to tell people that the snake died. So maybe the snake was, you know, allergic to the macho venom. The mythology goes on after that. It's, but this is like what I'm telling you is what we do know.
It's like the Chuck Norris joke in the like, after seven long days, the snake finally died or something like that.
Snakes don't bite. Chuck Norris bites snakes or something.
So his WCW days,
that would be like the prime age where I was like tailing off. You know, I think one common theme that I've had talking to almost non-wrestlers but fans as I've been going through this, and people who even are in the book who grew up with him and all these kind of things, it's like there's this lull everybody has, like when they get into high school. It's just you get girls and sports and, you know, SATs, and like it's just very, you just kind of, you drop it for a little while. I was at the exact age where like that was right around the time I kind of slowly trickled out. But then, like, perfectly, the Attitude Era comes in when I'm in college with plenty of time to watch every SmackDown and Raw and The Rock, and we all do it all in press. So, like, I came back at, like, the exact time. And then, again, like, drifted off when my kids were super little, because you drift off with everything when your kids are super little. And now my son's, like, 11, but has been really into it for the last 3 or 4 years, so I'm all the way back into it. So, you know, I think there are obviously, like, what, like anything else, you know, there's 10% of just die-hard, never-die, watch-everything-all-the-time-forever fans. And then there's 10% like, I, you know, casuals who, you know, dip in. And then that middle group is like some level of, you know, worship as kids, stay in touch with it now, or whatever they want to do. And so from the Macho WCW, like, I was very cognizant of that from the narrative style of the book, that I knew there were stories that had to be in there for a sort of, not appeasing in a negative way, but making sure you have to talk about that era. But also, you know, we're 260 pages in, and really most of the super high notes of his defining moments of his career that move you to, you know, get us, you know, like literature wise, you know, from the narrative arc of getting to outside of wrestling. I started writing, there was a lot of stuff in there, and it just kind of, I needed to get to the rap album and Spider-Man and Slim Jim and, you know, the sponsorships and the legacy, and then the, you know, all these things had to happen. And so I did watch, you know, in and out at that point. I definitely kind of lost touch in I called it in the book the dark macho phase, where the ponytail and the dyed black everything, and kind of the, and I even said it to Lanny, like, he just was sort of like that old man yelling, like when he's yelling, I'm the baddest dude on the planet, and he's 46 and looks, you know, it just, it didn't fit. He move, obviously, because of his hips and his knees and everything. And so, you know, Lanny had the best phrase around about that, because I was one of the areas when he was asking, like, you know, we got through that part of his life. And he was just like, he surrounded himself with gimmickry. He, you know, he didn't, in the beginning, he was the gimmick. And then he had Medusa and all these other, you know, all people around, just because, you know, he was still the Macho Man. He still had it. They're always talking baseball, right? Like, the fastball is the last thing to go. He still was charismatic. He still was everything else, but he wasn't striking anybody out, right? It was like he had a good promo, but then he couldn't wrestle and he couldn't, you know, really do the things that made him how special as he was. So it's in there. I touched a lot upon it. I had some interesting, you know, people talk about it there, but I really wanted to get into what's funny is at that point, he had reached a mainstream celebrity that was monstrous. It was almost outside of wrestling because of Slim Jim. And that's where he was doing, you know, philanthropy that I talk about and a lot of like public appearances that I thought were really interesting and unique to his career.
And like, I mean, you bring up Slim Jim, they still use his likeness today, because when you say Slim Jim, you go up to the random person, say, if you were to say, if you were to put a celebrity with Slim Jim, they would all say Randy Savage, like, happened to a Slim Jim. Yep. And he's still like on one of the boxes. I saw it at a convenience store today at a gas station. They call it the Savage size. And so it's just like things like that. And he was, again, you brought it up earlier, he was in Spider-Man. As far as I know, in the book it says, how did he get that role? Like, how did that come about?
Yeah, so he had an agent, but like he didn't reach out for the role. Sam Raimi, who was the director of that movie, wanted a real wrestler to play Bonesaw McGraw, and he had connections in Hollywood, and it came up, and he read for it essentially, and that was the guy that I guess Sam Raimi had in mind for Bonesaw McGraw. It had to be a real guy, real presence. Now, remember, Macho's, you know, in his mid-40s at this point, hadn't wrestled in a few years. So they Lanny said they gave him like 6 months to bulk up. And that's like that vague area of like, well, he definitely didn't bulk up like that naturally in your mid. I'm in my mid-40s now. And if you told me to put on 40 pounds, I don't know if naturally over 6 months that would be even remotely possible. So he did it. I mean, everybody saw how he looked, that big, you know, puffy and all that stuff. Yeah. He grew his hair out so he could have that. He grew his beard out the whole time and all that stuff. So he was into it, man. Like he wanted to know everything about what this character was about, who was a Spider-Man, all these kind of things. And for him to get on there, I talked to even, if you remember, the Bonesaw character had Bonettes, like his valets in the movie. And I was able to get a hold of one of them about what was he like on set? What was he, you know, what was his whole deal? Because it was 3 days and they all loved him. Like, you're not supposed to ask for autographs and stuff on set, but like she said, almost every dude on set was at one point, we have Macho Man here. Like they had it. So she got a picture. Eventually they kind of broke that rule afterwards and got pictures. The craziest thing about that movie that I learned, and I didn't know it, I've watched that movie a bunch of times, is Andy, they thought during the filming that he broke his neck in the movie. And it's actually the take they used is the one where he got injured. He does like a monkey roll off the ropes upside down, comes back and doesn't get the bounce off the top two ropes to push him forward. And it's in the movie. And if you freeze frame it now when we're off, you're actually going to like cringe when you see it. His head just snaps into the mat, and he goes down. And on set after that, he was down for like 30 minutes. Like, they weren't sure if he was going to move his legs. They didn't know what was going on. And he got up and was, you know, he asked if he wanted any to do one more takes, and being the pro he did. And then I guess he didn't leave his trailer for like 24 hours after that. And he called Lanny and was like, I can't move. And they thought maybe he would sue them or something, but he wasn't ever going to do that. But Lanny says from that point to the rest of his life, he couldn't like turn left. Like, he turned his whole body to go left. Basically, he didn't get like, you know, neck surgery or anything, but it ended any potential shot at any kind of wrestling, because he was afraid that whatever he did, and Randy didn't go to doctors very often. So he was afraid that whatever he did, it was going to be permanent if you made it worse.
That I when I saw that movie, that was back in the, I mean, internet was obviously around, but I didn't know he was going to be in it. So that was a surprise seeing the Macho Man in there.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I was interviewing Paul Roma for the book, and he was with Macho at like the perfect time where I always wanted to learn a lot about him, like right when he came up in the mid 80s and was becoming the counterweight to Hogan. And he was like, yeah, you know, at the end of the interview, I said, hey, did you, you know, I always ask the guys like two things at the end. Like, did, you know, when you lost touch there after a while, like, did you see him in Spider-Man or anything like that? And then, you know, I always ask, who else should I talk to? All that kind of stuff. And he was like, I'll tell you something. I took my kids to see Spider-Man. And obviously, I had no idea he was in it. And it wasn't till halfway through that I thought, oh shit, that's Randy Savage. He didn't even recognize. He was so different and so puffy, and his eyes were all, you know, he was playing a character, obviously, but he took a minute, even for me. I remember like getting home and being like, wait a minute, was Randy Savage just in this movie? This was unbelievable.
Yeah. It was the hand motion for me. Like, yeah, when he did that, that's what did it. Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's when I like, that's Macho Man. Like, yeah. And it's just unbelievable because he, you know, like, and this is, I'm kind of going back and forth because it was around the same time frame, just a few years earlier, the NWO was as popular as it can be. And Hall and Nash, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall were like the most popular guys. But like for the older guys, Randy Savage was that guy that everybody liked because he was that guy that he was always the one willing to get hit by, he'd get hit by Sting. He was always the one that took the brunt of a lot of the action. He was the guy that Hogan turned on. He was always the main guy that you would see a lot. And it's how many people, man is beloved. He did so much for the business too. And
yeah,
it's one of those things that I feel still to this day that he's underappreciated.
Yes.
And you were telling me that your son watches now and you've gotten back into it. How do you think Randy Savage would be in today's wrestling?
Oh, I love this question. You know, it's such a good, I've done so many thought experiments with Randy as I've done this. Like, you know, when you write a book like this, the person just lives in your brain for a very long time. It's like for the whole time you're writing, you're watching a movie in your head that no one else sees and everything relates to him and everything thinks of it. And it happened to be, you know, writing this where my son is like, LA Knight super fan, right? Cody Rhodes super fan. And LA is the first one that I've seen in a while who shades of Macho with his, you know, yeah, and all the stuff. I like him a lot. And so when you ask that, like the size thing really comes into play there because, you know, you have stars who aren't huge now. Ricochet is not a big guy. You know, you have some of these guys, CM Punk's not overwhelmingly physical. And, you know, even Seth Rollins, he's tallish, but he's not a bodybuilder type guy. LA is, you know, Cody's athletic, but again, not like a yoked dude. And so I think whereas back then in Macho's heyday, you've got him squaring off against Hogan, who, while he's much taller than Macho, Macho was able to make up the space, the visual space. But obviously he walked on his tippy toes his whole life. So he gave himself an extra 2 or 3 inches with that. Between that and the boots, he appeared 6'2" or 6'3", even though he was always chest out, you know, he always was able to match Hogan's size. You know, DiBiase was bigger than him. Obviously Andre the Giant was bigger than him. Steve-O and him were about the same size, but I think Ricky was a little bigger. And then you've got like, you know, you have guys who nowadays he would have actually been the big dude. I think he did get up to around 240. He was wide. He was athletic. I would have loved to seen a 28, 30 year old Randy Savage, like in his prime, right now. I think he would be, well, promo wise there's no one who can touch him. I honestly don't think anyone, maybe probably The Rock at his absolute peak with the characters and all the jokes and all the stuff could come close captivating wise. And you know, he had the catchphrases, so he's the only one I think, and he's said it before how much he idolized Macho growing up. But to me, it's Macho is the number one there. From a worker standpoint, a preparation standpoint, nobody would ever outwork or out prepare Macho Man. He had the history of his father, so he'd actually been wrestling since he was a kid, like knowing actually all the moves and how to do all this stuff. And I still think, like I said before, he's probably the most athletic guy we've had from being a true blue, like professional athlete. So I think he would excel right now. Remember, he didn't do it. He didn't Attitude Era do it where he didn't swear. He wasn't calling people out. You know, that was the one thing that it's like, you know, I don't have to swear to be funny. Like those dudes, that part of it was that they were swearing and talking about girls and talking about sex and talking about all these things. Macho was almost like he didn't even need to go to that edge of being R-rated or almost like, you know, pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable maybe on TV. He just was so in his own cocoon of craziness and awesomeness. I would have loved to see him today. I think he would have been fantastic. I think the high flying stuff, you know, he did, which was he pioneered it. So who knows what he would do now with the facilities they have, you know, and the things that he could work out. You know, they even have, you know, some of these guys now, like, the moves they're doing off the ropes, and sometimes definitely is too choreographed for my taste. It's kind of like, you know, you can see them setting up and it's not a rain on the parade type of thing. And sometimes if it's acrobatic enough, I'm into it, but I feel like you feel the same. Sometimes you're like, all right, we don't need the 30 seconds of everybody lining like a pinball and the backflip into the thing off the ropes. I don't think he would have been down for any of that stuff. I'm just guessing. But I think he would have excelled in any era. He excelled in the hardest era for him to excel at, right? Like his peak matches were against guys who were always bigger. I mean, my favorite match of his all time against Ultimate Warrior, he's a kid. He looks like a kid. Warrior's so much bigger than him in that match. So now having him be like actually a larger guy, you know, obviously, you know, some guys, Braun and whatever, who would have been bigger, but like of the A-list dudes, he would have been awesome against Roman, awesome against Cody, awesome against these guys.
Yeah. You know, you brought it up about like his past, and we had an interview with Bret Hart from a few years ago. I didn't get to interview him, but Bret Hart is my favorite of all time. And what he said about Randy Savage, his exact quote was, "Macho Man was another one where you didn't even need to talk when you were in the ring." He said, "Someone just said, quick, run out there. You got 20 minutes with Macho Man." And we didn't know what we were doing. You just figure it out. And he said, he's done that with Macho Man. He's just a total pro. And he said that Macho Man, to be able to do that, just I know from talking, hearing from other wrestlers, how good of a technical wrestler Macho Man was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people talk about that because there's a lot of people don't think about that from the 80s standpoint. They always talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling. Like if you wanted to see a lot of technical wrestling, Macho Man was a really good technical wrestler that a lot of people don't bring up. And he was just somebody that I really enjoyed watching some of when he got to wrestle somebody his size. Those were really good matches that he would have. Somebody like Bret Hart, like they were similar in size. I just always enjoyed him, and I liked him when he did commentary. I preferred him in the ring, but I still liked him on commentary. He was always just the focus. I always went to him. The focus was always on Randy, and I love that. So is there anything that, and I know I already asked you something that you've learned about him, what's something that like a fan should know about Randy that you think, and why should they pick up your book?
I think one of the things that stood out when I was like kind of getting deep into the writing is that this is a guy who reinvented himself for his specific goals several times in his life. And he always was about the fan reaction, even to the detriment of sometimes what may have been best for him. He was able to, and if you look at Randy, his biggest moments that we remember are losses, right? the Mega Powers splitting up, he never got to pin Hogan in the ring. He was willing to lose. He lost, you know, to Ricky Steamboat at WrestleMania 3 in the Mona Lisa of wrestling matches. He lost to Warrior, who was his peak rival at the time with Hogan, you know, kind of floating around the edges. Imagine that, right? Like the moments of glory, my moment of glory, all those things he talks about were losses. He won the title and everything, but it wasn't the way it was. It was always weird to me as a kid and even now that he never got the Hogan pin. And I know, if you go back, and I got all the issues of WWE Magazine and all that stuff, and even when he was the cover guy, they were giving Hogan the more run, more press, more of this and that. He was kind of the golden goose. And I think it's important to understand how much he set, as big as he became, and as he was clearly the they say, the kind of the 1A to the 1 of Hogan, even though he was champion for a while. They had more legs there, I believe. I believe there was another angle they could have definitely played for another year or so with, this is my thought, I'll run it by you. They should have had, instead of the Mega Powers exploding right when they did, a run where Macho became Hogan's. Macho was the point where he was so big that they set the line where Hogan was jealous. I don't know, like all of a sudden they did the reverse of what they did. Like Hogan, you know, Hogan's out there while Macho and Elizabeth are doing this, and he's kind of like wondering, like, you know, he's maybe doing this and Macho is like doing his, like they never really did the competing alphas. They just kind of immediately shifted to a rivalry, and they could have run that back for, I think, a year. That could have been amazing if they had that. And so to get your question is like, we get to read this book and we get to re-experience the joy of what it was like. It's a journalist book. I interviewed a zillion people, found, you know, thousands of articles, but I always took pains to take people back to what it was like to be a super fan at that time, why these moments were special. A bunch of times I'll say, you have to remember at this moment, if you're 10 or 12 or even 15, we had no Twitter between these matches. We had no news sites, no podcasts. We had, the last thing we saw was this. So when this happened, there was no leaking. There was no, we're hearing this or the dirt sheet got out, nothing. This was completely out of the blue, right? And so this allows you, it's almost like a time machine, an awesome wrestling time machine to go back. And hopefully you learn a lot more that you knew about Randy from his baseball career. And from that really does inform the work ethic he had with Macho. And then it really fleshes out his character and who he became, the serenity that he finally found later in life, his relationships that mattered. And a big through line in this is that he was really terrific with kids, all kinds of kids. The best interview in the book, and one of the ones that meant the most to me, was with actually with Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff's son, who Paul was close to his dad. Mr. Wonderful took his son on the road with him sometimes when he was the perfect age, 8, 9, 10, 11. He's on the Greyhound bus with Macho Man and Big John Snitka and all these guys. And he had a great perspective on Randy in particular that I think people are really going to enjoy. So I got those interviews, right? We've all heard Hogan talk a million times and Bret Hart talk a million times, and I used the sound bites where it made sense and talk to those guys where I could. But it's those other interviews that I think make this book special.
Awesome. You know, when you were bringing it up about those memories about when we were 9, 10, around that age, one of my favorite memories was when Elizabeth came back with them, when they got back together, when Sensational Sherry started
amazing,
beating them down, and she came out, and how that crowd erupted. And that was like, if I go back, I think that was the first time that wrestling kind of got like a, like I got very like happy, not like excited, but yeah, it was the first time that I had with wrestling. And there's a lot of fans that have talked about that was their first moment where wrestling had like an emotional part to it.
Well, that's really good microcosm. Think about nowadays, right? Somebody would have posted on Twitter, we hear Miss Elizabeth's going to be at the SummerSlam, or we hear Miss Elizabeth, right? We would have had so many rumors and oh, it's going to be there. This was like exactly an example of what I was talking before. Like, all of a sudden in the match, they cut to Miss Elizabeth. And as someone who's watching it, and even whether you were a kid and kind of all in and didn't know any of it was planned, or you were just suspended disbelief like you would a TV show, your reaction was still, oh my God, Miss Elizabeth's there. And then he loses. And that moment where he turns and thinks Elizabeth knocked him down, but not Sherry, he kind of hasn't figured it out. It's honestly like Oscar worthy. Like, he's got the fans eating out of the palm of his hand. She's sitting there. He's standing there. He hugs her. And you got the gorillas like, he's always loved her. It's just an upwelling of like emotion. And it was incredible. Yeah. And I don't know if we'll ever reach that peak today at any level, but this was storytelling. This was a romance that they had barred us through from 1985 when she shows up to be his manager with all those other guys in the ring and Fuji and them, like, who is this lady? To this moment, we had lived this for it was probably 3 years. I can't remember the exact stretch of it. And she was in another corner and the Hogan stuff. You just can't build like that now. I don't think it would be even possible to build like that now, that you'd probably see them on Instagram having dinner and all these kind of things, and it would suck. But back then, it was just the golden era of actually letting the drama happen, letting the build slowly happen, and earning a moment like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just such an unbelievable story, just of Macho Man in totality, just everything about him, just how much of an impact he had on so many people. That's one thing that Macho Man's one of those guys, when you hear his name, somebody bring him up, it just brings a smile to my face, because that was the guy that I liked. And I heard it recently with Sting, who just retired. There's a lot of people that had that moment with Sting when they bring him up. And I said, Bret Hart's my all-time favorite. And there's just certain wrestlers that had an impact on
people connect to you for whatever reason. There's a guy you see and you're like, you know, it's like baseball. Like that's like, mm-hmm. I was grew up in Boston. Like Mike Greenwell was my guy. Like, that was it. Like my dad had Yaz, and you know, before then they had Ted Williams and some guy between Jim Rice, but like I had my guy. Someone else could have been a Dwight Evans guy. It doesn't matter back then. Right. But like, for whatever reasons you latch on to these people at 8, 9, 10. And in the case of Macho, because he was around so long as a wrestler and had so many iterations, he just stuck with him. He was just like always there. And honestly, like YouTube is like one of the best godsends for wrestling fans around our age, because you can always just go back and like even writing this, rewatching this stuff with my son, I was able to take him through the whole Macho Man arc in like 9 months. And if he lists his favorite wrestlers, he's going to be like LA Knight, Cody Rhodes, Macho Man, right? Like, it doesn't make sense era-wise. Yeah. But he got into it and understood it. And, you know, it's really, really cool to watch. And I recommend anybody when they read this book, I'm putting out like a supplementary like YouTube thing that just like, here's some of the, you know, here's just the clicks you can go to if you really want to relive some of these amazing moments. Yeah. And he had, you know, the twirling of the finger around the, I mean, he did so many things that when you watch now, you take for granted, but not other than Hogan's ear thing, which he's talked about, kind of, he kind of stole from another guy, which he openly says he kind of was something else they were doing. People liked it. Macho had like 10 signature moves, like 15 signature catchphrases. There was no one else back then that was doing these things that he was doing. And so, yeah, he's a pioneer. I think he's one of the most important wrestlers we've ever had. And if you're writing the history of wrestling, he's like in the first paragraph.
You hit it right on the head there. Before we end this, I wanted to tell everybody that you will be at WrestleMania doing a signing for your book. You don't have the date or time yet.
I'll be there over the weekend. I'm signing a bunch of books at Barnes & Noble. I don't know exactly when just yet. There's another local bookstore we're looking at. And then where the media is, I'll be, you know, doing some other interviews and things like that. So yeah, I'm psyched, and I'm taking my son, so we get to, like, you know, all the bucket list stuff with wrestling. I mean, having a Macho Man book out at WrestleMania with my son at WrestleMania, you will not find a happier guy just trotting around Philly.
That's awesome. And you've done some other like books that I saw, and you've done a lot of work. I saw that you wrote a book on one of my favorite athletes of all time, Charlie Ward.
Oh man,
I lived in Tallahassee from 1993 to 1999.
Oh, dude,
So Charlie Ward, former Heisman winner. So when I saw that, I was like, oh my, that was my guy. And then I saw you did with Warwick Dunn. So I'm like, man, this is
Charlie this is Ward like the, is one of the, he's just one of the best dudes you're ever going to find. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyone who was around in that time, I believe firmly that we will not see anyone touch what he did, especially now with NIL, there's no real incentive to do so. But, you know, winning a national championship, winning the Heisman Trophy, and then about a decade later being the starting point guard for the Knicks in the NBA Finals, we are just not going to see that ever again. And whenever people talk about, you know, the greatest athletes of all time, they always say Bo Jackson, they always say Deion, and not knocking anything they did, but they were not the men who ran their teams. Charlie did it as the quarterback and point guard. Like, yeah, anyone who really knows these sports, Bo was just a physical phenom and ran over people and caught balls and hit balls. He didn't have to go out and know the whole offense. He didn't have to go out and run the outfield or anything like that. Charlie was – his sports IQ was, I believe, probably the highest maybe ever. Yeah. Physically, yeah, as gifted as it gets, emotionally just cool. And one of the best parts about that book is we became buddies. I spent a lot of time with him, obviously, for the book, and then – with his family. His parents are amazing. And we did a bunch of book signings around Tallahassee. We went down to his hometown in Thomasville and did stuff at his library where he keeps his Heisman. Just one of my favorite people. In addition to, now he's like an incredible high school basketball coach. He wins state championships now. So
that's awesome. And a lot of people don't know this, but he played baseball too at Florida State. And he was drafted by the Milwaukee Brewers. So I'm just a big fan of his. And
in high school. So he was incredible. His father wouldn't let him play organized sports till eighth grade, which is why I always say the same thing. Why bother? The greatest athletes ever Bo didn't play AAU anything. They didn't do this stuff. They let the kids develop. And so they wanted him on everything. He could swim. He was just one of those, like, give Charlie a bat and he'll do this. Give Charlie a ball and he'll do this. And the baseball coach invited him to a practice one day. And this is in the spring. And he gets in the plate, swings a few times, and just home run, home run, home run. and they're like out of control, and they're like, give him the ball to pitch. And it's like, he's throwing 77, 80, just gas. And the coach is like, can you play baseball? And at that point, they had just finished basketball. Football, basketball were his two favorite sports. And I guess he spot hit while he was doing some spring football and stuff like that. But like I always say, especially even with Macho, there's alternate universes. If there is like alternate timelines, I am confident there is one where Charlie Ward is an MVP outfielder for the Braves or something for 10, 12 years. There's these guys, they have to make decisions. And, you know, he obviously made a decision for basketball, you know, quarterback. If he came out even 10 years later, I think he would have gone to the NFL as a quarterback. He was every bit the athlete and player of name the person you think who was the dual threat person. They weren't ready for that. And Tony Dungy even said at the time, one of the biggest issues, the misconception is, you know, there was the racial component about black guys playing quarterback. But the other side was you needed a backup who could also do that. You couldn't draft a Charlie Ward and build your whole offense around him. And then if something happens, you have just a pocket passer. You really needed to build your organization around that. And people just were not willing at the time to take that leap.
Yeah. Well, John, I want to say thank you for taking the time with us today to talk about your new book that's coming out on April 2nd. It's going to be available at the following places and pretty much anywhere you like to get your books: ecwpress.com, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Indigo, bookshop.org. It's also available on ebooks like Kindle and Rakuten Kobo. So April 2nd, it's also available in store. So make sure you guys check it out. John, I want to say thank you again. It meant a lot to just talk about Macho Man. I really do appreciate it. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us. Tell everybody where they can follow your work at.
Yeah. So first, easiest place is my website, johnfinkel.com, JohnFinkel.com. And on there, you'll have the first thing is to sign up my newsletter. I have a newsletter that's got over 12,000 weekly readers called Books and Biceps. And every week I recommend a new book. I share books that I'm writing. I give some gym and workout motivation. I do a lot of author Q&As with, you know, a lot of sports writers who have books coming out. So if you're in wrestling and sports fans, I always have, if there's a big book coming out, I have a nice relationship, thankfully, with a lot of my fellow authors. And I have them come in and we do a 4 or 5 minute, you know, Q&A where it's all written out for them to read. And then, you know, Twitter and Instagram is at @John_Finkel. Go on and follow me. And if you buy the book, send me a screenshot. I have all kinds of cool giveaways. I have, hologram stickers of the cover. I have book plates to sign. So when you get it, hit me up with a DM of the screenshot and I'll get you some cool Macho swag.
All right. That's awesome. Guys, you can follow me at Rob Wilkins on Twitter. Otherwise, I am on Instagram at Fightful Rob and on Threads at Fightful Rob. Thank you for being part of Fightful.com. We do appreciate your time. Thank you, guys. We'll talk to you soon.